If the issue is one of importance, the government will resign. It must resign. And we will have another general election. Well, we'll have to leave that, I think, for the future to decide. I will only say that all the indications are that the strength in the country is still 46-44. And we may go through the blood, sweat and tears of having another general election, but if we do, it looks as if it's anybody's guess, even money, whether it comes back with a very small majority this way or that way. But it doesn't look like being a clear victory for anybody. Not now. That leaves us with the question, what will it do? And there I think we've got to distinguish between foreign and domestic matters. In foreign policy, you can, I think, now fairly say that the British government is already bipartisan. You will remember that when Mr. Attlee came here a few weeks back, he did say that he came authorized to speak in the name not only of his own government, but also of the opposition led by Mr. Churchill and of the Liberals as well. I think you can say that about British international policy. And, of course, international policy is going to dominate the scene, at any rate for the immediately foreseeable period. You can also say, for British foreign policy, that it is not subservient at the moment to any considerations of domestic party advantage. I don't think that either the government or the opposition are guiding their foreign policy line with a view to vote catching or with a view to maneuvering for position in the event of an election. I don't know whether that's true everywhere, but I think it is true at the moment in Britain. As to what the foreign policy is, well, perhaps it's rather difficult to say. Perhaps it's rather difficult at the moment to say what anybody's foreign policy is. And I'm a little embarrassed because I have never set myself up to be an expert on foreign policy. And since I've been in this country, it has been only too clearly brought home to me that the definition of an expert, which is operative in practice, is simply any person away from home. I think that we are puzzled and confused, to be honest. I don't think that puzzlement and confusion are at the moment a monopoly of the British. If you were to pick on anything that was central in British policy, it is, I think, a kind of blind, if you like, but nevertheless dogged conviction that somehow the United Nations has got to be made to work and that the United Nations has got to be made a bulwark against aggression and in support of peace. I think we're pretty confused as to what at exactly the present moment is the best way to do that. But I'm quite sure that that is the one main issue on which you could unite all British parties in the House and the great mass of the British people outside the House. It may be that we don't interpret that at every point in quite the same way as the American administration in the United States, or as many sections of the American people. It would seem that you have put a good many interpretations, sometimes conflicting interpretations, on this apparently simple principle. But I think some of our differences are to be explained by a fact which is very present in our minds, but not always perhaps as much in other people's, that the British are permanently engaged in a circus act. They are always trying to ride three horses at once. In other words, they live in three worlds. We live, first of all, in the world of Europe. And from time to time, rather scathing looks are addressed to to us from the opposite side of the Atlantic because we are thought to be backward in unifying ourselves with Europe. Parallels are drawn between the formation of the United States of America and the long drag in the formation of the United States of Europe. And some of the blame is laid at the door of the British. Well, there's a lot of background there, as you know. But it is true, of course, that we recognize a very close obligation to Britain, to Europe. And we may perhaps see the waters, the only difference is that we may perhaps see the waters of the English Channel as running a little more deeply and presenting a little more of an obstacle than they appear to be at this distance of space. Then we belong, of course, to the world of the British Commonwealth, second set of obligations and loyalties which have become very complex. As the Commonwealth and the independent members of the Commonwealth have come to be scattered all over the globe. I don't know whether you will forgive me if I refer to experience which I have had very often when visiting this country, and in which there seems to me to be a slight, shall I say, poetic justice. In the old days when I came to America, I always knew that whatever subject we talked about, before we had finished, somebody would say, "What about India?" And that I would have to stand as the representative of British imperialism and the British Raj in India. Did my best. May possibly explain why I've always been allergic to the subject of India. Came again, and there were other things. It was Palestine. Got through that. Came again, and I found a new attitude towards India. Once upon a time, my American friends used to say, "What is this wicked thing that you are doing in exploiting and holding down the Indians?" Now I find my American friends say, "What's the matter with the Indians that they don't toe the line?" You will forgive me if I did smile a little smile and say, "Well, after all, we can't have it both ways. Members of the Commonwealth are either independent or not independent." But all I'm really trying to say now is not indeed to make a point at a fair jest that you could have against us. All I'm really trying to say is that this is a second set of loyalties and obligations, a second world we have to live in, which becomes daily more complicated. And finally, of course, we are a member of the North Atlantic Community. I have often thought that we would be a much happier member if instead of things happening the way that I understand Mr. Hoover would like, and that is this great wide wall being built out with a big loop just to take in Great Britain, but omit everything else beyond, if instead of that we could do something much simpler. If our scientists, who invent such marvelous things, would devote themselves to finding a way of towing this little island of ours and fixing it in a more equable climate on some part of your great continent. But pending that, you see, we are a member of the North Atlantic Community, a very, very junior member, and a rather distant member. And I would only mention this so that perhaps you would, of your charity, remember that issues that may look one way to you, who can, after all, live in your own world almost exclusively, you who are a world in yourselves, that you would be, of your charity, remember that we do get frightfully muddled up between belonging to Europe and belonging to the Commonwealth and belonging to the North Atlantic Community. Well, I hope we take our obligations seriously. We have, I think, tried to do our part in support of this principle to which, as I say, we so doggedly cling. We are spending now a very great part of our resources on a rearmament program. I think if you will compare it pro rata between your country and ours that our total outlay, scattered, it is true, over a much wider area of the world, our total outlay represents a comparable proportion of our resources with that which you are spending, and a comparable mobilization of manpower. We have had, of course, now for 11 years, nearly 12 years, we have had a non-selective military conscription at the age of 18, now for a two-year period. So we have struggled, at least, to do something. And I think you can be quite sure that this present British government will go on struggling in that way. The last thing that I want to say takes us right back again to the beginning. I am very often asked whether the present British government, in taking on these new obligations in the defence programme in partnership with yourselves, will play down on its domestic social service programme. I think it may have to go slow on extensions of its social services. But I do want to say that I think it is very unlikely that it will reverse and go back on its tracks. I think the reason for that is a rather simple one, but possibly a rather important one if one is to get the whole British picture as it is. One of the characteristics of the social services has been that they are very comprehensive. And we would say, in a way, very democratic. That's to say that they are based on the principle of providing not for a particular class, not even for the underprivileged alone, but in providing a health service and a social security and a family allowance and food subsidies, quite literally, for everybody. And I think that this fact has a certain unifying effect in Britain at the moment. And that any government which wants to ask us, as presumably the present government does, to accustom ourselves to a little more austerity and to forego this and forego that, and pay a few more taxes. Any government which does that will probably feel it very important that the community should still have this sense that when it comes to basic essential needs, we are trying to treat everybody alike, and that we are getting the sense of common enterprise that goes with that. But that's just, let me say, how it looks to us. I can only end on a note of caution. Please do not think that I am offering this kind of program to you in any sense. The one thing that I think we have learned, particularly about economic planning and all that sort of thing, is that it can only be judged in a particular social and political environment. And our peculiar mixture of semi-socialism and social services and all that goes with it is essentially our mixture. And it is not offered for export, not even for dollars.